There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You are listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host. He's a criminal defense attorney and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He also blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh. I do not recognize the legitimacy of this program, and I may not participate.
Well, I'm sorry. That's not up to you. You're referencing this letter, the 8-page letter that came out from the White House, from White House counsel Pat Cipollone, saying why they think the impeachment inquiry is illegitimate, indeed why it's not an inquiry at all, and therefore they're not going to participate. So I guess, first of all, the president would be the defendant in this proceeding. Since when does the defendant get to say, I don't like this proceeding, I'm not going to participate?
You know, a lot of my clients sure would like if that were the case, but it's really not. I mean, this is more of a Fox News chyron than it is a letter. It's just a sort of 8 pages of bloviation over, you know, every political theory that the White House has about impeachment. It has very little to do with anything actually legal or any actual precedents with impeachment or any actual rule of law.
So is this letter actually important? Because I feel like I've been watching people treat it as big news, and I'm not sure I see news in the letter. First of all, it seems like a continuation of the position the White House has been taking for a year and a half, ever since Ty Cobb, the much more cooperative lawyer who was dealing with the Mueller probe, left the White House, where basically they were just not going to be helpful, not going to voluntarily comply with any aspect of the process. And furthermore, if you think of the impeachment process as similar to a grand jury process where you're deciding whether to indict, aren't you normally like not relying on the idea of a cooperative defendant in the grand jury process? I'm just not sure why it's important that the president says, I don't like that you're impeaching me and I'm not going to be helpful with that.
Well, perhaps this is sort of a frog slowly boiling type situation where it's been turned up so gradually we don't notice. But the letter seems to show a level of defiance of the constitutional process that's a couple of steps past what's been there before. I guess we won't know for certain until the Congress starts issuing subpoenas that the administration actually defies, or if the administration defies court orders directing them to comply with congressional subpoenas. That, I think, would be definitively over a constitutional red line and a constitutional crisis. Perhaps you're right that this is just more of the same of non-cooperativeness, but it sure seems to be a statement that they don't recognize the legitimacy of impeachment, and therefore they're not going to cooperate in any way.
But those are two different things that you described there. One is the administration not complying with subpoenas from Congress, and the other is them not complying with court orders that instruct them to turn certain things over to Congress. And we talk about when you talk about the idea of a constitutional crisis, you talk about one branch of government not recognizing the powers of another branch. But disputes between the Congress and the executive branch over the extent of Congress's investigative powers are not new with President Trump. And we've seen the previous administrations, including the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, pushing back on what Congress's opposite them saw as their powers to investigate and oversee those administrations. Now, the President Trump has been much more strident about his resistance and somewhat more expansive. But where I don't think we've seen the big difference yet is in terms of the involvement of the courts. When the court comes in as a referee and makes a decision about what the relative powers of the legislative and executive branch are, by and large, my sense is we have seen the administration comply with those orders. Now, that is a long process and a process that Congress is sometimes reluctant to involve itself in. So a lot of this stuff has not reached and will not reach the court order stage. But I think that's the jump that people are making based on this letter that is not yet warranted. This seems like another fight over whether the administration will just accede to what the legislative branch says it is entitled to subpoena rather than a claim that it's going to defy court orders.
Well, I guess you could argue that, Josh. I see it as a specific defiance of a particular constitutional procedure. I mean, the Constitution couldn't be clear that the House has the sole power to impeach, and the letter seems to convey that we do not recognize Congress's right or ability to do that. We don't believe it's legitimate. And if they carry through with that, I think that is a genuine constitutional crisis. But I guess you're right that the proof will really be once we start seeing specific subpoenas defied and maybe even specific court orders ignored. But I mean, one way Congress could handle it is rather than trying to enforce subpoenas, simply treat the administration's position as itself obstruction of justice. And, you know, that defiance of the proceeding has been invoked as a article of impeachment in the past, and it certainly could be in this circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't that seem like the likelier path? Because it seems to me that a lot of these questions about, you know, what courts would order and how those court orders would be enforced are very likely to be academic because of the length of time that process would take. It seems likely that Congress wants to impeach in the next few weeks, certainly by the end of the year. And so I assume that the process you'd have to go through to go to the courts and try to force compliance with subpoenas for whether you want text messages among the ambassadors involved in President Trump's dealings with Ukraine, that sort of thing. It seems to me that it's a lot likelier that Congress would do what you're describing there, basically say this obstruction of our investigation is another article of impeachment and assert its power directly that way.
Sure. And that's one thing they could do and therefore sort of defy the administration's attempt to drag this out. But on the other hand, as some people have pointed out, that makes the Senate trial harder and makes it a lot easier for Republicans in the Senate simply to say the evidence isn't here. So a lot of the accusations are going to depend for their credibility ultimately on digging up some of the things that have happened, some of the documents that we don't have yet. And I think it's going to be a considerably weaker case, both legally and politically, for Democrats in the Senate to make if they're just saying, well, I think we can infer that these text messages that the administration refuses to turn over are bad and probative of a violation.
Can we talk about some of the specific complaints that the White House has been lodging and that some Republicans, including Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, have been lodging? They're basically saying that the president is not being afforded various rights that you would expect for a criminal defendant, that they're not allowing him to call witnesses, that they're not giving his side subpoena power, the ability to basically discover evidence through the issuance of subpoenas. It seems to me that this is a category error, that basically those are things that you would expect in a trial. And if we got to the Senate trial, the president would have certain rights and powers associated with being a defendant in a trial. But this is basically an indictment process, and you would think of it as equivalent to a grand jury. The defendant doesn't have the right to call his own witnesses before a grand jury, doesn't have the ability to issue subpoenas under the auspices of the grand jury, that sort of thing.
Right. I mean, generally a target of an investigation has very few rights in guiding the investigation. You can request to testify before the grand jury when you're a subject or target. It's usually a very foolish thing to do, and the prosecutors don't have to let you, but sometimes they will because they figure you'll step in it and incriminate yourself. But as a rule, no. When the government's investigating you and seeking an indictment of you, you don't get to cross-examine anybody. You don't get to dictate how things go. You don't get to call witnesses. So if the House proceeding, if impeachment is seen as akin to an accusation, then right, the rights they are demanding don't seem apt. Now, part of what they're appealing to is tradition, in a sense that in the past, in some impeachment proceedings in the House, there has been more back and forth with the minority party and the majority party, and there have been more substantive proceedings. But that doesn't mean it's required. The Constitution is very clear that the House has the sole power to impeach. And what the Supreme Court has said is that type of language means that it's up to them and it's not a justiciable controversy. It's not something the courts can interfere with.
Relatedly, there's another matter of tradition that Republicans have been appealing to, basically saying, you know, you haven't had a full vote of the House to open this impeachment inquiry, and therefore it's not a real inquiry. And what Democrats say is there's no constitutional requirement that there be a vote of the House to open the impeachment inquiry. And when there are impeachments of other kinds of federal officials like judges, there often is no such vote. What Republicans have been pointing to is that in the past, when the House has moved toward impeaching a president, there has in fact been a House-wide vote of that sort. And so I guess, again, that's, you know, all that is an appeal to tradition, right? It doesn't mean that there's any legal or procedural obligation that they do that again. But I guess the question is, what drove that tradition? Why in the past was there this vote of the full House? And what is the reason that Democrats are disinclined to do that again this time?
Well, it might have been a matter of political cover or political posturing. Here, I mean, the reluctance to do it may be that the Democrats don't want everyone to have to make that vote before the next elections. They don't want people to have to commit now. They'd rather have it be after it and just vote on articles of impeachment. I mean, after all, there has to be a vote eventually, right? The House has to vote on proposed articles of impeachment to decide whether or not to impeach. It's not like they can just impeach him without a vote. But yes, there have been in the past sort of different types of votes on different types of procedural postures to refer things to committee or start an investigation. But it's not clear how that makes a difference. It really seems more like the Republicans just want to get all the Democrats on record and make them openly vote for it.
Well, I think the other thing is that those resolutions opening the impeachment inquiries in the past have had those provisions that we mentioned that allow certain subpoena powers for the minority party. And so who knows what Republicans might do with those subpoena powers, which they don't currently have in the House because they're in the minority, you know, to try to, you know, turn this into an investigation of the Bidens, that sort of thing. And so it's obvious why the Democrats would prefer to avoid that. And they can point to the context of a grand jury proceeding. Again, you don't give the potential defendant those powers ordinarily, but what Republicans do have to point to here is past practice with the Nixon inquiry and other things of that nature.
Right. We should point out, though, that apparently it was the Republicans the last time they were in power who enacted the current rules that allow the chair of committees to unilaterally issue subpoenas. So this may be sort of an issue of where a party is hoist on its own petard, captured by a procedural vehicle they put in place when they were in power.
Let's talk about some of the specific information that that Democrats in the House of Representatives have been looking for that the White House is standing in their way about, because this 8-page letter comes in the context of the White House and other arms of the executive branch defying various requests and subpoenas from the investigating committees in the House. In particular, Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, he's a major Trump donor, and he somehow ended up in the middle of our relations with Ukraine, even though Ukraine isn't part of the EU. Anyway, he had agreed to appear voluntarily before a House committee this week. But then the Trump administration told him not to talk to the House. And he said, you know, unfortunately, I'd really like to talk, but I'm being told by my employer that I'm not allowed to talk. And so now the various committees that would like to talk with Ambassador Sondland have gone and issued a subpoena. So I guess this, again, to me, is a question of timing. The House can go to court and seek an order for Sondland to testify. But how long is it actually going to take for the courts to work that out?
Right. And this shows the dilemma of seeking voluntary agreement to come up and testify. They didn't subpoena him initially. He agreed to appear, and then he just said he wouldn't. So now they're that much delayed having to issue a subpoena, wait for the date on the subpoena, and then see if he shows up. But once he shows up and they then have to make their decision about you know, how much he says, or if he doesn't show up and they have to make a decision about whether to try to compel him, that's when the real delays can start to come in.
But so are we talking months there?
Well, it depends. So right now we are seeing in various types of constitutional litigation a lot of very fast movement by courts, very uncharacteristically fast movement by courts. We might talk about later the New York lawsuit that the president brought trying to stop the New York State grand jury. And that has gone very quickly and is now before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And they have set a very short briefing schedule. So it is possible for these big issues to be litigated by the federal courts in a matter of weeks or a month or two, but it does still delay, and those delays pile up if you're not trying to do them all at once, if you're doing them sequentially.
Right, because, I mean, you know, what they would like to talk with Gordon Sondland about is there's this five-hour gap between some of the text messages where Bill Taylor, our top diplomat in Ukraine, had basically said, you know, I think it's crazy to tie the release of military aid to this request for assistance with a political campaign. And we know that Sondland spoke on the phone with the president in the five-hour period before he sent that almost lawyerly-looking text back, basically saying the president has been clear, there is no quid pro quo. People would like to know what was in that phone conversation, but also you might learn something from that phone conversation or from Sondland's own text messages that would give you new ideas about who to subpoena or what documents to look for. And that could set off again, you know, another period where you have to wait going through the courts. But I guess the question is, suppose we got to that point where a federal court had ordered Sondland to testify, and then we can get back to what we talked about at the start of the show. You know, is the administration going to try to defy not just Congress but the courts as to what its obligations are here? But it seems to me that wouldn't be solely the choice of the administration. You would have a court order against Sondland personally. So if the administration were going to try to have a posture of total defiance, they would be relying on Sondland to, in his personal capacity, refuse to comply with the order, and he would therefore, in his personal capacity, face whatever legal consequences there might be with not complying with the court order.
Right, and that's where the cracks start to show, whether or not people are going to go that far for the president to defy court orders, to risk imprisonment, and really risk their reputation permanently to the extent they have not already. The other thing you have to look at here is that these delays can pretty much play out forever, since you can first have someone refuse to show up. You can compel him to show up. Then he can start exercising various privileges and say that he can't answer specific questions. So if he had a talk with President Trump between those two key text messages, and the information we have is that he did, then he may well be instructed to invoke executive privilege over that conversation. And to the extent he was advising the president, that may actually be a legitimate exercise of executive privilege. So just getting him there, making him talk, is not the end of the analysis. That's what he's willing to answer.
What do you make of the fact that we did get this one voluntary interview with Kurt Volker? This is the former special envoy for Ukraine. He had resigned from the State Department, so he wasn't any longer a public employee, not subject to instruction by the State Department as to whether he should talk to Congress. And he gave this very long interview. There was a lot of news that came out of the text messages that he showed Congress, including those texts between Bill Taylor and Gordon Sondland. What do you make of the fact that Kurt Volker decided to talk? Would you have advised him to give that voluntary interview if he were your client?
I don't know enough about what he had to say to answer that, Josh. But what I would have done is to go through with him very carefully to see if he's implicated in anything illegal, and then make the call and either have him take the fifth if it's appropriate, or have him cooperate and try to keep him out of the mess as it goes on.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Rudy Giuliani. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. We mentioned last week that President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, had declared his intention to, quote, sue the swamp, unquote, in federal court. Giuliani's gotten a little bit more specific in an interview with Yahoo News. Now, first of all, Giuliani says the people who made fun of him over saying he was going to sue the swamp are, quote, nitwits, and that he, quote, got the highest grade in constitutional law, unquote. Giuliani says he has lawyers studying House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff's statements for the possibility that Schiff can be sued for deprivation of civil rights and for, quote, conspiracy to move the president at all cost, unquote. He also said Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan appeared to agree with a constituent who said federal marshals should, quote, hunt down, unquote, officials who defy congressional subpoenas. And Giuliani said that could be witness intimidation. So, Ken, conspiracy to remove the president at all costs, is that RICO?
Well, in the sense that it's ridiculous and it's not a thing. Yes, it is. none of this is real. So for a couple of reasons. First of all, again, the House of Representatives has the sole power to impeach. And that language the Supreme Court has construed to mean that the methods they use to get there are not subject to court supervision. So going in and saying that this process by which they're trying to impeach the president is unconstitutional is almost certainly going to be found by a court to be non-justiciable, to be what's called a political question that a court can't interfere with. In addition, you have the speech and debate clause of the Constitution that basically immunizes members of Congress for things that they do in their legislative capacity, so that you can't sue somebody for violating your civil rights by calling a hearing or voting for a bill or something like that. So all of this is pretty much nonsense.
As for witness intimidation, I mean, I imagine in a colloquial sense, a witness might find it intimidating if told that they could face legal repercussions for not complying with a subpoena. But that's not what witness intimidation means, right? I mean, when you say, you know, the marshal should go hunt these people down, that doesn't mean the marshal should kill them. It means the marshal should bring them to court and obligate them to testify. Aren't these things that a person who was being compelled to be a witness might face?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a little reckless for the Trump administration to be talking about witness intimidation when the president is basically saying, you know, we used to execute spies and that was swell in response to whistleblowers. But no, you need a specific intent to you need corrupt intent. You need a wrongful intent to specifically try to hinder somebody's testimony or change it or deter it. And I think that would be very difficult to show here. And if you could show it for Representative Tlaib, you could almost certainly show it for Giuliani and the president for many of the things they've said. So I think that's just more noise and more of the tactic of, you know, accuse them of what we're doing.
Is Rudy Giuliani Donald Trump's lawyer?
That's an excellent question, and it's almost a philosophical one. So,
because Rudy Giuliani declined to say this week whether they have a formal agreement of representation or when the agreement was formed, if such an agreement exists, and that it's none of our business anyway.
Right. So most of the time, there's not this bright line on-off switch, you're somebody's lawyer or you're not. It comes into play when you have to answer specific legal questions, like, was this particular communication privileged under the attorney-client privilege? So under that analysis, the question is going to be whether Giuliani was giving Trump legal advice in a confidential way, and as opposed to political advice. So one important factor of the attorney-client privilege, which would certainly come into play in inquiring into any communications between Giuliani and the president, is what type of advice was this person giving? If you're giving business advice or political advice, that's not attorney-client privileged. It's only if you are giving confidential legal advice to somebody. And it doesn't have to be an established client that you've signed up and has paid you. It can be a prospective client. It can be someone you're representing temporarily. The key issue is that you're giving them legal advice and it's confidential.
So, I mean, we've all seen John Grisham's The Client with Susan Sarandon and Brad Renfro, and he gives her $1 as a retainer and then she officially becomes his attorney. So it's not like that. It's not like you need that like sort of ceremonial entry into a business relationship for and that's when the attorney-client privilege begins?
Those are only factors. So if you're evaluating whether somebody is giving you confidential legal advice and forming an attorney-client relationship, the factors you would consider would include whether you're using words like, I'm hiring you or I'll be your lawyer, and whether you paid them. But it's not the only factor. So there is some wiggle room here. And certainly Giuliani has given inconsistent statements and answers about to what extent he's representing the president. But those will not ultimately completely determine it. It will be other factors like, was he giving legal advice and was it confidential? But it's key to recognize that the attorney-client privilege applies to communications with the president. So cavorting across Europe, pestering Ukrainians is not itself privileged. Those communications are not protected.
When Giuliani says it's none of our business whether he's the president's lawyer or not, I mean, I guess that's true in the sense that, you know, he has no obligation to tell a reporter. Where this would become our business would be when he would seek to assert the privilege if he did, right? So if, you
exactly.
know, if Congress called him to testify and Giuliani's been sort of indicating that he intends to defy congressional subpoenas, so this is another case where maybe we'll have to see that go through the courts. But conceivably, conceivably you could have a situation where Giuliani ends up before a congressional committee and declines to answer certain questions on grounds of attorney-client privilege. That's where it becomes our business what the actual nature of his relationship with President Trump is.
Exactly. And that's where Congress would have to make the tough call. Do we seek to compel this? Do we drag this fight into court? Do we even use our inherent contempt power? Or what do we do about this?
Speaking of the president's lawyers, the news reports on this keep changing, but it seems the president may be bringing on former Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy as an attorney. Gowdy, like you, is a former federal prosecutor. He was also a district attorney. What do you make of the idea that he might be on the president's legal team?
I mean, it seems fairly shrewd. And I mean, given this is a president who chose Michael Cohen and Rudy Giuliani, it seems uncharacteristically shrewd as a choice of an attorney. This is somebody who is a trial lawyer, who has experience as a prosecutor and a private lawyer, and who is very familiar with congressional procedure. So he would seem to be unusually well qualified to handle this sort of combined legal and political battle. So it would seem to be, again, an uncharacteristically good choice.
I want to talk about some stuff that's been going on in New York. We've been paying attention to this case where you have the Manhattan District Attorney who has filed a subpoena seeking the president's financial records from his accounting firm, Mazars. And the president sued to block his accountants from producing his financial records with a very broad theory of how not only the federal government but also state governments are not only not allowed to prosecute him, but they can't investigate him while he's president. They can't investigate people close to him while he is president. Federal Judge Victor Marrero was very unimpressed with these arguments, and he issued a ruling against Trump, basically saying that that he cannot block this subpoena, that these records will have to be produced. And so the president, I gather, lost on multiple grounds here.
Right. It's amusing because the president's lawyers conveyed to the judge, hey, if you don't rule by Monday, we're going to treat it as a denial and appeal it. And the judge pretty much said, okay, here you go, and completely blew their case out of the water. The judge ruled on two different bases. You might remember we talked about this before, that the district attorney's argument is this is not something that the federal courts can handle, because there's this doctrine called Younger abstention, under which federal courts are not supposed to interfere in state court criminal proceedings.
Basically, if you're upset about something the Manhattan DA is trying to do to you, you're supposed to sue in a New York court, not in a federal court.
Exactly. And the president had been saying, oh, that doesn't apply. The issues here are too important. The president's power is too important. And the court just completely rejected it. And what the court said is the president's argument basically would immunize not just the president, but his family and everyone working with him. And he said this would potentially enabling both the president and any accomplices to escape being brought to justice. This is really rough language from this judge. So the judge said absolutely he had to abstain under this very well-established doctrine that the remedy, if the president doesn't like the subpoena, is to challenge it in New York State Court. But the judge also said, hey, even if the Court of Appeals say it's not abstention, I'm going to rule on the merits too. So I'm going to look at the argument and I find that it's completely bogus. So what the judge said is that all these Department of Justice memoranda that everyone has been relying on since the Nixon administration, he really questioned their authority or persuasiveness. He said these are just internal memoranda. They're argumentative. They do not form any sort of legal authority that I'm obligated to follow. But even if they did, the memoranda clearly do not establish that this immunity to indictment of the president establishes an immunity from any sort of investigation or any sort of pre-charge criminal procedure. And he discussed in his 75-page opinion in great detail the separation of powers issues and why this would basically give presidents an absolutely free pass, not only to themselves, but to all their associates for anything criminal, including things completely in their private capacity. So he ruled that even if he didn't abstain, that he would dismiss the president's case. Now, the president immediately appealed that, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has issued a amazingly fast briefing schedule. These days, federal appeals usually take about 2 years from the time you file your notice of appeal to getting a ruling. The Second Circuit has set a briefing schedule where it's all going to be done really in October.
Wow.
It's amazingly fast. So they seem to understand the importance of it. They did issue a stay so that the president's accountants don't have to produce the documents until they rule. But that's not unusual, particularly given the very short time frame they've set out for making this decision.
So one thing that's interesting to me about this case is we've talked a lot about that Office of Legal Counsel memo that says you can't indict a sitting president. And we've talked about, you know, the memo is old, but it's never really been tested in the courts. And there's a reason it's never really been tested in the courts, which is that you would need a test case, basically, where DOJ went out and indicted the president. And then the president sued and said, no, you can't indict me. And then that would get up through the appeal courts. And that's a very unlikely thing to happen. And so it's interesting to see a judge even addressing the merits of that memo. But am I correct in my assumption that's not going to end up being binding law, that basically it's likely that this will go to the appeals court, and if it ever got to the Supreme Court, and they would probably deal with this on the abstention issues that you discussed there, that basically this is not an issue for federal court to consider, so they would never need to make a ruling on whether the OLC memo was correct.
Right. So courts of appeals, even more than district courts, tend to be somewhat judicially conservative, not in the political sense, but in the sense of we're going to decide as little as is possible. And if they take that stance, then they'll probably just decide on the abstention issue. And I suspect they'll agree with the district court. And they won't find those memos controlling. They may find them persuasive argument, but they're not going to be controlling. For one thing, and this is what the trial judge pointed out, is that they really talked about federal indictments and not state indictments.
This is the OLC memo is about what the federal government can do. It doesn't say what right. The Manhattan DA can do.
Exactly. One of the things you have to remember is that we were so focused on those memoranda during the Mueller investigation because they were DOJ policy and Mueller was bound by them, particularly because he's somewhat of a rule follower and is not the sort who would challenge prior DOJ precedent in rulings. So they were very important in the Mueller investigation and to his conclusion that he could not indict the president. They are not so much important or controlling to a state investigation of the president.
So you described that very rapid briefing schedule. This case may be resolved by the end of this month. Am I right in my assumption there's no reason to assume the Supreme Court would feel compelled to review ruling from the Second Circuit, so we might have a final decision in this case by sometime in November, and then the Manhattan DA would be able to obtain these financial records, and then would we get to see them if this is resolved in favor of the Manhattan DA, and they get to look over years of the president's financial records? Is any of that going to make its way to the public?
That's more than one question, Josh. Yes. So once the Second Circuit rules, maybe the president will ask for review by the entire Second Circuit called en banc review, sort of a rehearing of the case by more judges. Maybe he will petition the Supreme Court to hear it, hoping that there will be a political decision rather than a legal one. But I don't think there's a great chance of the Supreme Court taking it. In the past, the Supreme Court has not broken down on these types of issues along party ideological lines. Ultimately, though, if the New York District Attorney wins and the accountants are compelled to turn over these documents, they should not become public. This is a grand jury investigation. Under state law, like federal law, it's supposed to be confidential. It would be a crime to leak those documents produced to the grand jury. But certainly, if the grand jury ends up indicting anybody, or if they wind up taking steps like search warrants or things like that, if the district attorney does, then we might wind up seeing more details from what's produced there. But Josh, I can't help but notice how for years now, the president has really been pulling out all the stops on multiple legal fronts in federal and state courts, doing absolutely everything necessary to prevent his tax returns from being produced. And you really have to wonder on some level why.
And so that's interesting. So, I mean, if there was something in the tax returns that could be the basis of a criminal indictment by the Manhattan DA, then that could be a process by which so at least some of them would become public.
They could be, or it could simply be an ego thing. They could simply not support the Trump genius billionaire narrative that Donald Trump prefers to offer to us.
And so there's another avenue by which certain politicians have been trying to force disclosure of these. Well, there's several avenues, but another one is a California law that says in order to appear on a presidential primary ballot in the state of California, candidates must produce their tax returns to the state of California. And so the president has had better luck in litigation over this law. He got a court ruling saying that California cannot impose this requirement. And I guess it has to do with not allowing states to just come up with a whole bunch of new rules about who can run in federal elections?
Exactly. So the California law said that party candidates have to disclose their tax returns. And the federal judge here agreed with the president on almost every single argument he made about why that was unconstitutional, that it violated the clause of the Constitution that sets qualifications for president, that it exceeded the clause that gives states certain rights to regulate elections, and that it violated equal protection in the First Amendment in the sense that it deprived people of candidates by discriminating between major party candidates and independent candidates, for instance. These were never 100% clear issues. I think when we talked about this months ago, we said it was a little cloudy how it would come out. But this was a 100% win for the president. It now goes to the Ninth Circuit, which will not be as friendly a venue for him. But it certainly seems as if he's got the upper hand at this point.
Can we talk about Jacob Wohl?
If we must.
So in addition to being under felony indictment in California for securities fraud, moron conservative dirty trickster Jacob Wohl held a press conference in Virginia last week to accuse Senator Elizabeth Warren of being a cougar. That's what the banner at the press conference said, quote, Elizabeth Warren, cougar, unquote. And Wohl produced a young, muscular man who says Warren hired him so she could dominate him in a BDSM sex scene at a Hilton Hotel near Route 128 outside Boston. This claim, of course, is not true. For one thing, the Gigolo website that the man claimed to work for says that Warren is not a client of theirs and this young man would not have met their hiring standards anyway. But this press conference nonetheless led to much amusement, including from Elizabeth Warren herself, who used the occasion to tout her degree from the University of Houston, where the mascot is the Cougars, and to note how she wants to make college affordable for young people today like it was for her. So, Ken, if a person makes a provably false statement of fact about you, and that statement improves your reputation, do you owe them money?
Well, she certainly turned this to her advantage, I think, in every possible way. But here's a curious quirk of the law. Normally, you need to prove damages to prove defamation. But there is a category in which damages are presumed. You might have heard of it. It's called defamation per se. Now, contrary to popular belief, that doesn't mean that you've automatically proved defamation just by asserting it. You still have to prove the statement was false. But if you prove certain categories of lies, then at least nominal damages, a dollar, are presumed. And one of those categories, because all of these laws were written in the 19th century, is accusing somebody of unchastity. So I think it's pretty clear that they committed defamation per se under any number of archaic state laws by accusing Elizabeth Warren of unchastity. They may have also committed defamation by asserting that she flew a rent boy to Boston for these purposes, because that seems very contradictory to her environment. Plan. But of course, she handled it the right way. You don't swing at these pitches, and it would be very hard to prove damages. And I mean, Jacob Wohl is so stupid that it is not entirely clear how you would go about proving knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard of the truth. He is kind of in that special category of people whose ability to grasp things may be so improbable that it's hard to prove what they intend or what they know.
Well, isn't there also an issue of that a reasonable observer familiar with the context would have to understand it as a factual claim? So, like a reasonable observer familiar with the context of Jacob Wohl being that he lies all the time. Could he argue that, you know, I'm so dishonest that no reasonable person listening to me would assume that I was telling the truth?
Yes. I mean, he could argue, if he's willing to debase himself this way, that any reasonable person seeing my latest driveway-based press conference would understand that this is political theater, that it's farce and not a genuine statement of fact. And that would be an issue for the court to resolve.
So I guess Elizabeth Warren should probably pass on suing him over this. Finally, speaking of idiots, Michael Avenatti. There was a news report this week that Michael Avenatti had sued Stormy Daniels, saying that she owes him money for legal services. But my understanding is that's not actually quite true, right? He hasn't actually sued her?
That's right. What he's done is file what's called an attorney lien. So you may remember Stormy Daniels sued police in Ohio for what turned out to be a completely bogus staged arrest of her. That was political retaliation at a strip club. Michael Avenatti helped her at the initial stages of this case. Later, they parted ways. She has now won a $450,000 settlement in that suit. What Avenatti filed is an attorney lien. It's basically a statement by an attorney saying, I am owed some of the proceeds of this case. So attorney currently representing Stormy Daniels, don't distribute the money. And it is a very florid, angry piece written to my complete astonishment by one of my former colleagues from the U.S. Attorney's Office. And it basically asserts that she did him wrong, he's owed millions of dollars, and so forth. But it's only the first step. As he admits in the document, to collect on the lien, he would have to sue her. And he absolutely cannot do that right now because he is being, after all, prosecuted in three separate federal cases, one of which accuses him of stealing from her. So if he sues her, he opens himself up to full-blown discovery, and he has to make a decision between taking the Fifth and losing the case or answering questions and incriminating himself in his federal criminal cases. So it seems mostly a posturing public relations move rather than a substantive one. It's sort of a big middle finger to Stormy Daniels and a way to throw a wrench into her collection of money in that case, at least for a while.
But wait, so where does that leave her if she wants her $450,000? I mean, so there's a lien, and so does she then have to sue to obtain, to get removal of the lien if he's not going to sue to enforce it? I mean, is it like a lien on your house where like you wouldn't be able to sell it because the lien exists?
It's a huge mess, Josh, because, I mean, you're talking about he's trying to invoke California law in Ohio and in a federal court, and it's not clear ultimately what law will prevail. It's not clear whether or not she can get declaratory relief that the lien's invalid. There are ethical implications. Attorney liens are an ethical minefield, and the California State Bar might be interested in the process. So it's not entirely clear how it's going to come out. I think it's inconceivable that he will ultimately prevail on this. However, it could be effective in tying up the money for her for a long time.
Well, don't hire Michael Avenatti as your attorney. There's much more for us to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We will have another Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday. There's already a lot to talk about this week. We're going to be looking at the situation in Syria, where the president has abruptly pulled our support for the Kurdish forces that have been holding on to much of northern Syria. We will, of course, also be talking about impeachment developments. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter. We're at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 310-853-3514. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.